You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
You've probably heard the story of Alexander Fleming discovering penicillin by accident when he left his window open and a mold spore drifted onto the bacteria he was studying. You might not realize, though, that many of the most revolutionary breakthroughs in science and medicine have been largely the result of luck. Dr. Morton A. Myers writes about some of science's most fruitful mistakes and happy accidents, serendipity in modern medical breakthroughs when scientists find what they're not looking for. It's published by Arcade, and I'm very pleased it has brought Dr. Myers to my show today. Hello.
How do you do?
There seem to have been so many happy accidents in medicine. Dramamine, the pap smear, aspects of stem cell research, LSD, x-rays. How often is luck a factor in medical research?
Well, it's hard to know the exact percentage, but I think if one follows through on these things, you come to the realization that many of the major advances that we have now absorbed into our culture and into our healthcare have occurred through the major element of chance.
But doesn't the scientific culture work against relying on the unexpected?
Yes, I think so. And I think it's unfortunate that the degree to which the element of serendipity could be fostered has generally been ignored. Programmed research, disciplined research, centrally managed research has become the main fulcrum for the hope for further advances.
Cold, objective facts. And that's it.
Yes.
So, and then that's what most people think of science as being.
Absolutely.
Somebody who sits there and works meticulously day after day, and finally it all works out.
Exactly.
And we admire hard work more than luck. So should we be concerned that so much is dependent on chance?
No, I don't want to overstate the degree to which chance can be very beneficial. I mean, there certainly remains the positive benefits that can be achieved through programmed research. But I think, as you're suggesting, in the popular mind, science comes out through dedicated, logically directed research in ivory towers by highly disciplined researchers who are very assiduous in rationally pursuing a particular objective.
And what happens when they do discover something by chance? Are they willing to admit it?
Certainly not at the time. I think for many reasons, among which are perhaps there's a feeling that it might diminish their status. It might put, if they're in an academic center, their tenure at risk. And it certainly might reduce their chances for furthering receiving grants. It's generally not until the awards have been given. In fact, if one reviews the winners of Nobel Prizes over the last 100 years, many, at the time of their acceptance speeches, admit the major role that chance contributed to their discovery. And if you call up contemporaries and ask them, say, how did you come by this? If they've already received at the end of their career the awards, they'll be surprisingly frank in telling how serendipity entered the picture.
Now, the real trick here is to recognize that you've stumbled across something important, isn't it? I'm assuming that a fair number of scientists have made major discoveries and not even realized it, and it had to wait for somebody else to make the connection.
That's exactly the case. I mean, the history of missed opportunities throughout research is I think, surprising. How people have approached what could have been a very beneficial response, but not at the moment, for a variety of reasons, recognized it. And yet there is something about having a particular type of mind, an open mind that's not constrained by conventional wisdom, that's not constricted by dogma, that is allowed to generate possibilities from an unexpected observation or an inadvertent finding that would lead that kind of person to pursue it to the point of a major discovery.
But what happens when a scientist makes that kind of decision and wants to go with his or her gut? Are other people supportive of that? Is there likely to be research money if somebody says, you know, I have a feeling that if I just do this for a little bit longer, I'm going to come up with something really important?
Well, I think That's exactly the case. I think that's unfortunately part of the problem. In government-sponsored research, the objective has to be fairly clearly defined in the application for research funds. And even if in the course of that investigation some unexpected finding occurs, the course of an investigation generally can't be distracted in that sense to pursue that, but has to resume following the original objective.
So scientists can't stray from the original hypotheses?
I think there's the basic idea, first of all, that subsidized research leads to developments, not to discoveries. And even within the framework of government-sponsored research, which involves billions of dollars every year, and in the case of the war on cancer, certainly for the last 37 years, that is not fostered. And a scientist, even the people, the two researchers who discovered the basic physiology that ultimately led to all the statins, the cholesterol-controlling agents, were not able to get federal funds for their, and they had to sort of get from an assortment of other money that was available to them, the resources that allow them to pursue something that eventually won them the Nobel Prize.
Now, you say development rather than discovery. Discovery, of course, is what we celebrate. So something else is going on here. Is this the result of, I hate to use the word capitalism and make it sound like anything other than just the system that we work under? Development makes more sense because then you can patent the thing and go further with it, whereas discovery involves a lot more playing around and perhaps even finding something that somebody else might have found before you?
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that kind of perspective. But the basic fact is that discovery requires surprise. I mean, to put it simply, if one knew something was there and goes after it, that's not a discovery. So discovery, almost by definition, requires serendipity. And it occurs by going after one goal and stumbling over something. And it takes, as I say, a particularly astute mind, therefore, to pursue that unexpected finding, to something that was not being looked for, in order to come up with a true discovery.
You talk about the phrase in Latin, post hoc ergo prompter hoc. What does that mean?
Well, it's one of the fallacies of reasoning, of assuming that if B follows A, A was the cause of B. There's an interesting anecdote that's derived from the science fiction series that was written by Frank Herbert, who describes a man in a desert sitting down, and there's a fence in front of him, and one of the slats of the fence is missing. So through it, every day, he can view a desert jackass that is walking by. And first he sees the nose, and then the head, and then the body of the animal, and then the hind legs, and then the tail. And day after day he observes this, and finally he jumps up with a shout of eureka, saying, "I've got it. The nose causes the tail." Mm-hmm. And that kind of thinking is often inherent in a certain type of scientific research that I think leads things astray.
My guest is Morton A. Myers. He's written a book called Happy Accidents, Serendipity, and Modern Medical Breakthroughs, When Scientists Find What They're Not Looking For. It is published by Arcade Books. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Dr. Morton A. Myers. His book, Happy Accidents, Serendipity and Modern Medical Breakthroughs, is published by Arcade. Louis Pasteur said that chance favors the prepared mind. So this is kind of what you're saying as well, isn't it? Why isn't, if Louis Pasteur said it, and then Paul Ehrlich said that scientific discoveries come from the four G's, they're German words, but they translate as luck, talent, money, hard work, and persistence. Why aren't more people aware of that when they fund scientific research?
Well, I think on a personal level, most people do have experiences with serendipity. Serendipity is a term that's been absorbed now into our culture and generally is taken to mean a pleasant surprise. But what it really is and its original concept is looking for something and yet stumbling over another finding that leads to an observation or a discovery of even greater value. The idea of chance entering into research is very common. But I think, as I say, it takes a well-trained mind that's open to contradiction, that can respond to the exception to something in order to pursue it. And much of funded research is not so much along those lines, but rather directed, targeted research to a finite goal that perhaps adds another footnote to what's already known. And that's what I mean by development rather than discovery.
How is this applied to the search for cures for various cancers or for HIV/AIDS?
Well, the history, for instance, of most of the fundamental chemotherapy agents, the agents used against cancer, happened through serendipity. In World War II, the use of mustard gas, even by the Allies, that was taken for possible response to a German use of mustard gas, a major maritime disaster that liberated the mustard gas, and the seamen reacted by a very much marked lowering of the white blood cells. That was turned around with the idea of, I have the solution, what's the problem, and applied and developed as nitrogen mustard, which was the first chemotherapy agent. And successive to that is a whole range of other chemotherapeutic agents that were discovered through serendipity, through either folklore, through research on bacteriology, through research on nutrition, and fields not allied intimately to cancer itself, but from other disparate basic science fields that gave us our current fundamentals of cancer chemotherapy.
But there are many people who would love to see chemotherapy eliminated and science move in another direction, actually find out what triggers cancers and how we can stop the body from doing that sort of thing and not have to rely on poisoning the body to the point where we bring people sometimes near death to save them from dying.
That's true. That's what Susan Love, the famous breast surgeon, refers to as slash, burn, and poison, mm-hmm. referring to the elements of surgery, radiation therapy, and chemotherapy. And the exciting development now in cancer research is related to the gene that has now been recognized as fundamental to turning a renegade cell and causing a mutation in its DNA structure to divide ceaselessly. But even here, I think, even in the field of sophisticated disciplines like molecular biology, chance has and I'm sure will continue to play a role. Despite high technology, despite defined goal, people will still stumble over an unexpected finding and hopefully have the mental awareness to pursue that.
But those are too few and far between. What we've been seeing in cancer research, as I understand it, is that different programs make some kind of a deal with a pharmaceutical, and that becomes a fiefdom, and then that becomes the thing that is tried to the exclusion of everything else. And if somebody comes along with another idea and isn't backed by a pharmaceutical company, then that idea might not even be tested.
What this recalls, for instance, is lithium. When lithium was discovered by chance for and it remains the mainstay in the treatment of the manic phase, particularly of manic depressive syndrome, what's now called the bipolar affective syndrome.
Now, lithium is basically just a saline solution?
Lithium is a very simple element in the periodic table that's found worldwide in a certain type of rock. Mm-hmm. But a researcher had a wrong hypothesis that urates were the cause of mania, and to make it soluble, he formulated lithium urate. And what was shortly proved is that it had nothing to do with urate, but rather the lithium. Now, that kind of thinking lingered for a long time because the pharmaceutical companies would not market lithium because they couldn't patent it and therefore make a profit from it. And there are elements of this even today, but the drug companies for the last 20 years at least have become more of a marketing machine than they have for an engine of research and development. They're still the most profitable industry among the Fortune 500, but their efforts in billions of dollars is on direct-to-consumer advertisements on TV, for instance, supporting efforts in a doctor's office in terms of things like lunches and so forth. And in fact, in the last several years, there's been a plethora of books that criticize and deride all of these false efforts of the drug industry that have not produced any major life-saving drugs for a number of years.
So who's doing the research? Universities?
Much of the research now is not so much by the major pharmaceutical companies, but by the biotech companies, as well as at universities and other academic centers.
Can you explain the problems that you cite in your book with the peer review process?
Yes, and I think this is something that's coming out now to the surface and becoming popularized in terms of criticism. Peer review was originally set up with a very noble idea to allow scientists to evaluate other scientists so that they wouldn't be subject to the lobbying efforts of outside influences or no less the government itself. So it's based on a noble tradition. But what has happened is that peer review now is rather biased. There are definite biases in a peer review system to support what's referred to as the old boy network. Much of the money goes to elder researchers and doesn't allow an unconventional younger person to break through to produce a new idea. And in fact, if you look at many of the recent advances, for instance, identifying that the cause of ulcers are bacteria or that there's a liver system that would allow the development, as I said, of cholesterol-lowering agents. These ideas were not funded by the government because they broke away from the dogma. And even scientists, physicians, drug industries have such a commitment already to a certain set of beliefs that they're not open to any new thoughts that might arise from a peer system that itself stifles innovation.
Are there any research organizations that have started to encourage a certain degree of thinking along the other lines?
Well, one excellent example is outside of this country, and that's the Medical Research Council in Great Britain, which was founded on the idea of funding not so much the project, as the NIH does here, for instance, but rather the person, to find a free-thinking scientist and support him initially with enough funds and resources to develop a new idea, and then as it further evolves, to continue and add incremental support. That at at Cambridge University has now developed the Cavendish Laboratory of Molecular Biology, which has won 9 Nobel Prizes and is equal to any other biomedical research center in the world. In this country, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute has now set up what's referred to as the Genelia Farm Research Center, 40 miles outside of Washington, D.C., $500 million establishment to support independent research and to allow small groups of researchers to follow any ideas that they have without any predetermined goals set by central management.
And I would assume that if somebody came along with a new way of dealing with Parkinson's or MS or any of the so far untreatable cancers like melanoma, that a lot of money would be made. So I would think that there would be people who'd be interested in supporting this kind of research.
Well, one of the problems is the drug industry feels that it's extremely, and there's a lot of truth to this, is extremely costly to establish a new drug. The generally cited figure is $800 million to come out with a new drug. Much of that is...
Oh, you mean because of the testing, the FDA, and getting the drug accepted?
Clinical trials and so forth. On the other hand, most of them historically have reached for what they call blockbuster. And by definition, a blockbuster drug brings in at least $1 million of revenue. Lipitor, as an example, taken by 16 million Americans, brings in something like, I'm not sure of the exact, something like $13 billion a year to Pfizer. So, and on the other hand, what are referred to, there's a host of diseases where the a lot of the basic science is understood, as in sickle cell anemia or cystic fibrosis, that the numbers are just not large enough of people involved for the pharmaceutical companies to feel they should invest a lot of money in pursuing for a drug solution to it.
And that makes me very sad.
It's a very sad state of affairs.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Morton A. Myers. His book, Happy Accidents, Serendipity in Modern Medical Breakthroughs, When Scientists Find What They're Not Looking For, and it is published by Arcade. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. My pleasure.